Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hi, Chris Evans here with a special edition of the Best of the Breakfast Show podcast with Sky from Virgin Radio. With the rather wonderful Louis Theroux talking about his lockdown diary. He wrote his in case we forgot to write ours. I didn't write one, but thank goodness Louis did. This is awesome.
If there's an unexpected story to be told, our next guest is the man to find it and tell it, especially when the stories are about him. His new book, Through the Keyhole, Diaries of a Grounded Documentary Maker, is out today. So listen closely as we get thoroughly Theroux-y with the one and only Louis Theroux-y. Oh,
good morning, Louis.
Good morning. Good morning. Hey, can you hear me all right?
Yeah, I can. Come in. 1, 2, testing. 1, 2, 2. Yeah, good. Good. It's working for me. Is it working for you?
Great. Yeah. Yeah. I love this. We're keeping the lockdown alive. Right? It would be like those Japanese generals in the Indonesia. You know, they were found in the Philippines in the 70s. They didn't think the Second World War was over.
They didn't believe anyone.
I don't believe it. It's still surging. There's variants out there.
Louis, your book is fantastic, mate. Well done. It's so funny. It's so surprised. Very candid. It's very vulnerable. It's gorgeous. Is it safe to say that March 17 to March 17, 2021 was your most alcoholic year to date?
Definitely. No question. No contest. And it's it'll be one thing, you know, because I'm comparing it with student years. But the difference here, of course, was that 90% of the alcohol was consumed in the kitchen. Sometimes while hiding from the family, you know, sort of sneaking middle and mid, you know, on Mondays and Tuesdays, like that sort of non-drinking days of the week. But that was how I managed my mental health, it turns out. And you know, that it's a temptation to say, like, I was drinking too much, which I definitely was, but by choice, right? I had decided that was what I was going to do. So, I think part of it was discovering bourbon. I don't know how much of a drinker you are these days, Chris, but have you ever tippled with bourbon?
Yeah, I have tippled with bourbon, and you've got to be careful with bourbon and whiskey because they do have this really seductive allure over you if you're not careful.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not like, oh, I'm going to go up, I'll bring a little glass of red wine with me. It's not that. Yeah. You have a slug of bourbon before bed, and it's you're playing havoc. You're basically juggling with fire. And you will feel it the next morning. So proceed with caution on that.
Well, I think the thing with whiskey and bourbon, I'm not sure this is a conversation we're going to have, but you can still taste it in the morning on your tongue. And it's funny because when you have other drinks, you know, something's happened inside you and you know you've had a drink, but it doesn't, you know, your mouth tastes like the bottom of a birdcage. The thing about bourbon and whiskey is it tastes like you've just drunk it when you wake up. And that's where it becomes a little bit dangerous.
Yes, you feel highly flammable the next morning, like you've been marinated, you know what I mean, in gasoline. But on the book, and with respect, so you mentioned that the book was vulnerable, and thank you for that. Like, it's definitely, I was trying, my intention was to try and be as figuratively naked, but, you know, as possible, to try and confess to my most undignified side. And there was plenty of that in lockdown for sure. You know, as a sort of dad to three boys, as a husband to a wonderful wife, but definitely I was the lowest on the totem pole on the family front. And, you know, I wanted to sort of make myself an object of study in a way, you know, having been deprived of my normal journalistic feeding grounds by being, you know, unable to fly. You know, I had three projects more or less mothballed at the beginning of lockdown. I thought, well, I need to sort of feed on something as a sort of object of inquiry, and then found myself and family life as a sort of subject of interest.
And that really comes across because, you know, now you sort of know, not completely know, but you sort of know what it's like to be Theroux.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a kind of mixed experience. I think the hardest part, I'm willing, this is my... this is my job, right? And to some extent, as I've got, I used to be precious about being in the public eye. And, you know, going back years when I did When Louis Met's about people like, well, Jimmy Savile and Paul Daniels. And I used to think, oh, well, I need to be invisible. I can't have a profile. So I didn't do much in the way of press. I didn't do much in the way of self-revelation. And then as time went on, I sort of crept out from behind the screen gradually. And now I'm sort of flinging myself in the eyeline of the public saying, you know, here it is. This is what I am. I don't have many secrets. I don't have, you know, I basically my vices are probably the obvious ones of, you know, drinking too much and being an insensitive man in various respects. But I think that owning up to that is a public service of a sort. At least that's what I've persuaded myself. For my family, you know, I think the ones where I've had to prune back the material is more to do with preserving some sort of privacy for my family and my wife.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I didn't notice that, by the way. It doesn't come across like that because I don't know what you left out, but it's a right riveting read.
Thank you.
You were many things. I like the way that certain revelations sort of, they sort of creep out and they slowly unfold. And then I was saying this to Bass and Rachel earlier on, that your observations are quirky, they're funny. But, you know, on every single page, because every single day from March 17, 2020 to 2021 is here in this diary, so there's a reminder that sort of, it makes you feel a little bit sick inside or whatever. Maybe like, oh God, yeah, I remember that happening. I remember that moment, you know. Yeah. And you talk about your first panic buy in the co-op in an aisle when you met catering dad.
Yeah, he had enormous packets of pasta. He was a dad at my kid, because I have three boys, 15, 13, and seven as they are now. But the little one was five at the time. Going back a long way, aren't we? This is March 2020. And it was that weird feeling of if you can cast your mind back, of what's going on here? What, you know, yeah. It's on the news, the government saying don't go into work. We weren't quite in lockdown, but it was suggested that, you know, it's sort of like this feeling of a gathering storm. And it felt slightly unreal because none of us knew anyone in the UK at that time who was ill, because it hadn't really hit our shores. It was just in the offing. And there was a sort of weird sort of frisson of excitement about it. Like, oh, this is all different. This is kind of, you know, a bit like at school when, an alarm would go off and you didn't think, oh, we're all going to be burned down. You thought, oh, wow, the lesson's been disrupted. You know, we're all going to have to march out and something different is going on. But when catering dad, he had his van and everyone's sort of swapping bits of intel about what's happening. And he had a van with lots of huge packets of pasta. So I bought an enormous sort of almost like a kind of sack of coal sized bag of pasta that lasted me for about 2 months and made me feel very smug as the whole weeks went by. And it turned out this was as serious or maybe even more serious anyone imagined, and I was there with my kind of like black market rations of pasta, of penne pasta by the bin.
All right. So you look at yourself as a subject in the book, but also you still study your craft, and you were a very early adopter of Tiger King, weren't you?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I watched it probably at the same time everyone else, which was, again, probably first few weeks of lockdown. But the difference was that I had spent 10 days living more or less with Joe Exotic back in 2011. So I had this weird double effect of, this is an enjoyable and outlandish program. And also, I know half these people and recognize many of the locations. And also, that one of the things I confessed to in the diary is that Joe had hosted us in 2011 at a rather sumptuous barbecue. And I remember at the time being thought, wow, these are great cuts of meat, you know. He's really giving us a slap-up meal. How nice of him. You don't often get hosted in such a high style by a contributor that you're filming with. And then when I watched Tiger King, I saw that actually one of them, John Rinke, Joe's friend, confesses that they would use reclaimed expired meat from Walmart and feed it to customers and also sometimes eat it themselves. So I'm fairly sure that the barbecue I had at Joe's was expired meat from Walmart. Not exactly what I wanted to learn. But, you know, but the Tiger King thing was a viral phenomenon, right? And the striking thing about looking back is, you know, this term of virality in a time of when we were going through a virus, you know, and that virality, you know, one of the obvious, if I can get deep on it, I know you like, Chris, you're a thoughtful and deep thinker, but what struck me about the whole pandemic was that actually it was almost a side effect of a kind of greater virality, of interconnectedness, and that in suffering and struggling and then enjoying aspects of lockdown, that we were all victimized in different ways, not just by the virus, but also by things like global warming, by tech. Like, tech is a theme in the book, the way in which our apps and our phones are increasingly controlling us. And so I suppose I'm trying to make a greater point. You know, as we emerge from the coronavirus and sort of return to normal, for me, the takeaway is actually, let's not forget that we are in different ways still enduring and struggling a kind of, you know, what is a side effect of the human condition as it exists in 2021. Am I making any kind of sense?
No, completely making sense. I mean, I'm here still in self-isolation, you know, and you're talking about, you know, there is the virus, there is COVID-19, but, you know, we live in a viral world now more than ever. And, you know, there are many strands to this viral sitar, if you like, and they're ongoing. And this is where we live. And as the Second World War and wars that have gone before accelerate research, development, evolution, whatever that might be, this has done the same thing from a viral point of view.
Yeah, big time. And also that, you know, that we, you know, with COP, you know, the summit going on or just finishing up, obviously we're more conscious now about global warming, but this, the machines, I'm worried about the machines. Like, what struck me in lockdown was how we all relied so much on laptops, phones, apps, different kinds of software, but the ways in which they were not just, you know, we were using them, but they were using us. Not, I don't want to sound like, well, techno kind of neo-Luddite and paranoid, but I don't think there's any doubt that we've become interdependent with machinery in a way that is kind of, to some extent, irreversible, right? I don't see us getting off that anytime soon, and which has effects that we haven't really fully gamed out and understood. And so that's, I suppose, part of the way we live now, and something we need to figure out. I didn't say that in a very technical way, but that's the way it is, isn't it?
Yeah, that doesn't worry me so much from a philosophical point of view, purely because, you know, motorways aren't going anywhere soon, you know, and they caused a similar kind of issue when they were first around, as did the bicycle from one village to the next. But this is just the way we are, isn't it?
That's right. But motorways, as we've discovered, have contributed to global warming. And I don't mean to, I'm not being, is the term Cassandra? I'm not being saying, oh, the sky is falling. But isn't it? I just find it really interesting wherever we go from now, it will be fascinating, you know, whether it's the metaverse or whether it's, you know, this idea of people living in Sims.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm aware I've veered us off into a kind of techno conversation, but Elon Musk during the... Well, I used to amuse myself by listening to Elon Musk on Joe Rogan's podcast and him talking about, you know, we may already be living in a sim, and the idea of us inhabiting some sort of virtual reality that we don't even know that we're in. Anyway, it doesn't keep me up at night. I just find it an intriguing prospect.
I'd love to see you with Elon Musk for a week or two. That'd be amazing. I'm sure you'd love that too, wouldn't you?
He'd be number one, I think. When you think about dream,
he's the man at the
candidate.
Moment.
He's like a figure from a Marvel comic, isn't he?
He's the real name, Iron Man, isn't he?
He's Iron Man with a touch of Doc Ock. You know, he's Iron Man is the hero side, but he might also be one of those villains who's who by night has been ingested by his machinery. You know, his new idea is brain chips. We're all going to have brain chips. I don't think we're going to be forced to have them, but that cognitive enhancements that turn us into androids. And his point is that we're already androids because we rely so much on our phones. Half our brains exist now. We're interdependent with our phones in a way that makes us androids. So I'll give him an approach. Have you ever interviewed him?
No, I haven't come close, but I am completely fascinated by him. Completely. I'm consumed with him.
Goes up in a rocket ship. He invented a kind of flamethrower, I think. I love every aspect of him. Well, from a sort of journalistic point of view, I find it totally intriguing.
Same age as you, I think.
He probably would be, yeah.
I think he's 51,
it's scary when you look around at people who've achieved... What is it worth? 100 billion? And now I think, like, where have I done something wrong?
It's so funny. If you go back further, it gets even worse with Elon Musk, by the way. When you think where you were in your career and where he was in his, yeah, and how he swiftly overtook you. It's interesting. It's one of those things that...
How do you grow up in a rocket while also making tens of thousands of electric cars? You know what I mean?
I know.
Like,
I
can't make a cup of tea while checking my emails. I'm sure you can.
Let's talk to you about one of your heroes of lockdown, Joe Wicks. You opened the book with two quotes, one from Nietzsche, one from Joe Wicks. From Friedrich Nietzsche, in times of peace, the warlike man attacks himself. From Joe Wicks, never easy, burpees, never easy. Which was the most useful to you under lockdown? I'm suspecting Joe.
The Wicks, by far. Yeah.
Of course.
He's the one, more than anything else, who made the whole experience not just bearable, but actually self-improving. I started, you know, I'd always had this fantasy, you know, in the last 10 or 15 years, like, one day I'm going to get fit. Like, one day, not now. Maybe I'll take a couple of weeks off and go to a health farm. One day I'll sort it all out.
Not now.
Maybe in a few months. And then in lockdown, when the first Joe Wicks workout took place, my wife alerted me to it. And we all got out there as a family, me and the three boys and my wife. And we did it. And I thought, well, that was, you know, keeps you busy. We weren't leaving the house. And then I did it the next day. My wife stopped doing it. My kids sort of stopped doing it intermittently. But I kept at it more or less 5 or 6 days a week. I did it yesterday. I haven't done it yet today, but I will do it. And discovered that I felt not so, you know, not only did I sort of physically look and feel better, but mentally I found it like a huge sort of charge, like an enormous positive, you know, the positive effects on my outlook and my temperament were immense, and kept up with it. And I'm not going to say I'm ripped. It's not for me to say, but people say that I look better, it's such a temptation, because I said at the beginning, like, I tweeted, I'm going to come out of lockdown like a prisoner coming out of the hole with a six pack and a bad attitude. And now I feel like I've got my six pack and a positive attitude. And every day I think, I wonder if I should tweet myself like with my shirt off, showing off my six pack. And then I think, no, that's not who you are, Louis. Stop it. You're not one of those people.
Maybe it is. Maybe that's who you really are. Maybe you've discovered the real you. Maybe that's the whole thing.
Maybe. Okay.
It's funny because I've been here like for 10 days now, and I usually run every day, but I haven't been running at all because I can't. Because I'm not allowed out. So I've adopted this little exercise regime, and I actually feel fitter now than I have after my years and years of running, because it's a different kind of fitness. You do these little... It's very Joe Wicks-esque. I've got my pull-up bars that I nicked off my wife on the frame of my bathroom just over my left shoulder here. I've got a little power plate, vibrating power plate that I bought 17 years ago and haven't used until this week and last in the garage. I do feel entirely different.
How many pull-ups can you do?
I can't do any. I can't do any. I can do like 3 or 4 if I swing my legs a bit, but I think that's cheating. I could have a go now.
I think I could do 3 pull-ups.
That's what you want to tweet. You want to tweet that video, that little TikTok.
Do you think so? Maybe I will.
Yeah, man.
See, and also if you
boomerang it right, you only have to do one. Look, you could do. It looks like you're doing 1,000. You're right up there with David.
That's
Goggins.
A good point. That's a good point. I think I could do 4. I'm going to say 4, and I'll set myself the challenge. I'm going to put that on social media today.
Do you have a pull-up bar?
I do. It's still in its box. I asked for it one Christmas. One Christmas, I said, get me a pull-up bar. Then I'll get fit.
Well, you think, how is this going to hold my weight if I just sort of tuck it under the bedroom, the door frame from my bedroom through to the bathroom? Is this going to work? Is the whole house going to come tumbling down? And it just, the science behind it, the engineering, the design, phenomenal, Louis.
Is it?
Phenomenal.
You put it in a doorway, right? And then it hangs on. I've got to have
that's
to
what
find
you do.
That.
What you do. If you've lost it, I'm going to send you one as a present, because I want a pull-up brother. I want a pull-up brother that can't necessarily pull up.
I want to get you to do your first real pull-up. I want to be your motivator. That's the key. It's like with Joe Wicks, he's like, he's such a good, his enthusiasm is infectious.
Yeah, he's a great sort of fitness buddy to have on your telly. Our kids did that every morning, 9 o'clock, bang, as he's smashing all those world records. Talking of world records, I think, and I don't know because I've not checked this out, and that's remiss of me, especially talking to somebody who is renowned for their assiduous research. But do you think maybe perhaps you set the world record for number of bikes stolen during lockdown as well?
Okay, good point. Yeah, I think I had. Well, I don't know if I set the record. I had two stolen, and I'd had one stolen, or maybe two stolen the previous 6 months. So they weren't all in lockdown. I look at it as a sort of charitable endeavor. If someone wants to steal my bike that badly, they must really need it. Like, that's how I console myself. You know, so it's a bit nice like when you get a parking ticket and you think, well, you know what? It's going to the council, and they are very underfunded. And it's annoying, and also since then I can't actually. It's obviously not totally selfless on my part, because since then I've got a better lock, and I've had the same bike for about a year now. So obviously I've staunched the wound. But for a while I sort of was operating a one-man charity scheme of donating bikes to thieves.
I wonder if you're being targeted, if it was the same person again, he's going to do it again. He's going to buy a brand new bike again. He's going to not lock it properly, and them having...
It could well be. It happened twice in Soho and once in Shepherd's Bush. And I think in the Soho one was so weird, because I'd only been in an office for 45 minutes, and I came out and I thought I was going crazy. You know, the embarrassing part is you spend half an hour just thinking like, well, I'm sure I locked it here, but maybe it was over here. And then you wander around and it dawns on you gradually that, no, it's been tea leafed. Although I'm a keen cyclist of a sort of, you know, getting to and from work sort, going back many, many years. And it's quite a common thing in my past to forget. I don't know if you've ever had this, of forgetting where you've actually, not having it stolen, but actually losing it, forgetting where you locked it up. And then weeks later, walking down some back street in the West End, and be like, that looks like a familiar bike.
No, have you really done that?
Yeah, I've done that. Yeah, I've done that. That's funny. My bike. Yeah,
that's
I've done
funny.
That. Yeah.
talking to Soho, there's a lovely bit in the book about Soho. You go to Soho with your friend, your wife, and your friend Sharon, and you go out for dinner, and your wife says to you, it's a case of, do you think you were... It's funny how we've all reacted, responded to the effects of subconscious effects of COVID-19 on us. And your wife says to you, either you're trying too hard to be funny, or you're just trying to be too funny, or maybe a combination of both.
You're trying too hard to be funny. And it was because it was the writer, Sharon Horgan, who I hadn't met before, and who's hugely talented. And, you know, she's an actor as well.
Yeah, she's amazing.
And I got I get quite... when I meet someone famous who I admire, for the first time, I get like a lot of people, like I'm impressed by talented, famous people, and so I have a habit. So my wife tells me, I'm sure she's right. I go into slightly manic mode of trying a bit too hard to be funny. So Nancy, my wife, called me up on it. She's like, as soon as Sharon had gone off to do something, and she said, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "I'm just, you know, trying to be funny." She said, "Just be normal." And I said, "Well, this is my new normal. My new normal is me being manically unfunny."
I love the fact you tried to, because it's really annoying for me that, because you are very, very funny, and it seems so natural. I love the fact that you sometimes over try. It makes me feel a lot better, let me tell you.
Yeah, big time. Yeah, yeah.
I know we only have you for half an hour, which I was disappointed with, because basically I've made a note on every page, and every page there's a talking point, a conversation that I could have with you. It's great. We're talking to Louis Theroux for the last few minutes about his... It's a brilliant book. I think this has number one in the Sunday Times bestseller list, written all over.
And
I really mean it. It's fantastic. Theroux the Keyhole, Diaries of a Grounded Documentary Maker, Louis Theroux. I was going to talk to you about your epilogue, which is gorgeous and sensitive, and you talk about your wife and how you sort of re-fell in love with her. Not that you weren't in the first place, but for completely different reasons. I feel exactly the same way about my family and my situation. I feel so blessed. I feel so lucky, luckier than I ever thought I was in the first place. And I felt pretty lucky to begin with. But if you don't mind, Louis, do you have a copy of your book there?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. It's right here.
Can you do me a favour? Can we finish this interview? And I'll say goodbye now. And thank you very much. And well done on the book. It's awesome.
Thank you.
Can we just finish the interview with you reading Thursday the 2nd of July, because it's beautiful.
Thursday the 2nd of July. Okay, yeah. Wow, that's awesome. I don't even know what happened on Thursday the 2nd of July. Okay. Well,
pull up a chair, everyone.
Here we go. Thursday the 2nd of July. Okay, ready? Should I just go for it?
Yeah, just thank you very much indeed. This has been
thank
Louis
you,
Theroux.
Chris.
Louis Theroux through the keyhole. Off you go.
Thursday the 2nd of July. Nancy had a socially distanced book group at a friend's house. I put Ray down. Dad, you have to always breathe, otherwise you'll die, right? Right. Then I said, what if you forget to breathe? Yeah, or if you say a really long word. Good point, I said. Like, bada 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 ning nong ning nong ning ning, he said. I guess you just have to be careful, I said. Dad, what is it when you crack the system? What do you mean? On The Incredibles, they crack the system. It's like solving a puzzle. You figure out the solution. Oh, I thought it was like they broke it. Well, they didn't break it. They figured it out. We read a book about being chased by a bear. Good night, Ray. Dad, I don't want to go to school. Oh, why not? I don't want to grow up. Well, it's not until Monday, so that's still 4 days away. Dad, I don't want to be 6. I want to be 5 or 4. You got plenty of time to not grow up. Look at Arthur and Jack. They're much older and they're still young. Right. Time to sleep. I tucked him in, thinking about him not wanting to grow up, hoping that it meant he was happy as he was and wanted to pause his life and enjoy the simple pleasures of a 5-year-old forever.
That was Louis Theroux. His new book, Theroux the Keyhole, Diaries of a Grounded Documentary Maker, is out now, and you will not read a more life-affirming, heartwarming, COVID-reminding, conscious-urging book than this one, All Christmas. If you've enjoyed the chat, please do rate and review it and recommend it to your friends. And if not, this never happened. All right? Stum.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.